TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Deep Adaptation Conversation with Joanna Macy, hosted by Jem Bendel. Jem Bendel is a professor of sustainability leadership at the University of Cumbria, UK. He's founder of the Deep Adaptation Forum, an online monthly conversation about how to prepare for what Bendel considers as a very likely collapse of industrial civilization. Joanna Macy is a scholar of Buddhism, systems thinking, and deep ecology, and a respected voice in movements for peace, justice, and ecology. In the summer of 2018, Professor Bendel completed the paper entitled Deep Adaptation, A Map for Navigating Climate Tragedy. It was rejected for publication by reviewers of an academic journal. Bendel refused to make changes to satisfy academia and published on the internet. There, the paper has gone around the world. He has become an important voice among Extinction Rebellion, the school strike, and sunrise movements, and individual thinkers who offer insight and support in the worsening climate crisis. Joanna Macy is author and co-author of 13 books, among them Active Hope, How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy, and Coming Back to Life, the updated guide to the work that reconnects. She joined the conversation from her home in Berkeley, California. There she had just celebrated her 90th birthday. Here's Jem Bendel.
I first discovered your work about 20 years ago. I think I used your systems game in my teaching quite often, but I really reconnected with it when particularly the work around how to hold space for people dealing with difficult emotions that were in the heart of in the middle of a sixth mass extinction and the terrifying situation that confronts us. How do we find some sort of both equanimity but also engagement, so not to turn away but turn toward these difficult times? And I felt your book, Coming Back to Life, really, really speaks to that. So first up, I'd love any thoughts you could share on how you feel your work is perhaps finding greater relevance and resonance around the world right now, sadly, because of a growing awareness of our predicament.
Well, because this work sprang out of an awareness of this predicament, but that was 42 years ago. I had been an environmental activist with my family and my teenage children, and we knew a lot. And then it was my son, his freshman year in university, when I visited in Boston, took me to a day, one day, looking at the threats to the biosphere. So this was 77. It was the Cousteau Society. Jacques-Yves Cousteau himself was there, but it was much more than the destruction of the oceans and the pollution and the loss of plankton was a big concern then, but it was the oil spills. But then it covered all the other things as well. The depredation on the species, the extraction of the deforestation. So this was 42 years ago. And this was all information that I was familiar with. I was in my middle 40s then, or late, whatever. I just turned 90, so it's hard for me to figure back that far. But it's about halfway.
Happy birthday for recently.
Nel mezzo del cammin de nostra vita, halfway in the course of our life. At any rate, but there was one thing I saw, and it just tipped it. And on my way back to where I was staying on a train over the bridge, the River Charles, it just suddenly hit me that our species was destroying our world. And what I saw, which somehow pulled out the scaffolding that had kept all that information as information in my mind, my mental acuity there, just cascaded down through my body, my heart, my feelings to my feet. And I thought, we're done. And so the question for me from then was, how can I live so that I am present enough, in full presence, so that I could enjoy it and be useful? Two good questions. While my species is destroying it. And that led to the work that you encountered 20 years ago and a few months ago again. It was evident to me after a year and a half of sort of a dark journey that people did not lack information. And for me to tell people what was happening, particularly the people who were responsible or who were voting, but almost anybody, except a certain diehard activist, but almost anybody else, they would turn away and say, well, there's nothing I can do about it. It is a shame, isn't it? Oh, such a shame, but there's nothing I can do about it. There was a reluctance to feel mental pain, moral pain. So that was what started the work, and that seemed central. How can we be with discomfort, mental and moral and psychological discomfort? And I didn't like it myself, but I got very curious. And so that went right from the start, because I was teaching meditation at the time as well, began to experiment with how close you could get to the fire. And then we found simple things that we're still using, like open sentences, and much better than questions, that help people. And because I was looking for not to persuade people about how bad things were. That your eyes would just glaze over. That was the one thing they didn't want to hear. How could I get the voice from inside them, that's the most voice they most needed to hear, which was a voice of caring? And so that wasn't so hard.
I see. Really does come through in your work. The voice of caring inside them, to connect back with that rather than the fear of the pain that they might experience, that the fear of despair that would keep them away from connecting with their compassion and their benevolence. I was wondering how Buddhist philosophy and also Buddhist practices you think or you're finding helpful for yourself or for other people as we sense this ever greater terror, as this destruction of life on earth seems to be coming to our own doorstep.
I did from the beginning see what makes it difficult for us coming out of the Western mind and theistic traditions is that we see ourselves as separate individuals, basically. And this has grown, of course, extremely strong in the last five centuries of hyper-individualism. So what for me, as a Westerner and an academic and an activist and a professor, and was to not just read about it in books about them, but to working with Buddhist refugees from Tibet in the 60s, I encountered their way of being. And that intrigued me. And what I found was that the experience of being a who you are is not put in an isolation cell or a prison cell of being a separate and permanent self or individual. And that is actually, that separateness and permanence is actually a delusion. And it's a delusion created by your appetite for power and praise and aversion. How do we handle such overwhelming, the world that I need, the world that has brought me forth, that I am now living on with my family and my job, is coming apart. What'll I do? I'm lost. How can I? So the move that the Buddhists made, and now that you can make with an understanding that our world is alive, that our earth is a living system, that everything we are and know and feel is part of that earth. If you make a shift, break free of that isolation cell of the separate self, always so greedy for recognition and so ready to compete. I got to find somebody. Who can I blame for this?
Could I just pick up on that one, which is fascinating to me, because you've talked about your work about inviting people into that place of compassion, and you've just said also to one of the ways of coping with a sense of that you're losing control in your life and things are falling away is to blame somebody just on that issue. So I find that quite a lot of people who are either concerned about climate change or who are clearly activists on climate change are talking about who to blame. And it may be oil executives, or it may be a whole country that's profligate, or a whole class of people. And also some people say that it's actually strategic or tactical to have someone or to blame. I was wondering what your thoughts are on blame in general, but also where that might come from in terms of your spiritual philosophy and so on. And I'm thinking also, what are your thoughts on whether or not young people should be blaming us for the predicament we've created? So children today who are facing such a terrifying future.
Well, I'm not hearing blame from Greta Thunberg on, by and large. I only hear them wanting us to hear them. They want our ear. Listen to me, they say. Don't turn away. Listen. Care. Please care about this. You've got the levers of power, as she says, to whether she's in Davos or talking to the House of whatever parliaments where she can get out without taking a plane. Frankly, I don't get blame from the young ones and the youth and the millennials.
Thank you. I was wondering, the other aspect of blame is self-blame or guilt. And if you hear people who feel guilty about this situation and our contribution to it, what's your response?
Yeah. You know, there again is a focus on the separate self. It could be endless. You can look in the mirror morally from now to doomsday. That is so boring. We've got to graduate from that. We have a planet-wide disaster where we finally step out of your separate self-adulation, because self-judgment and self-praise are so equal. You're focused on how great you are. We could just take it off as if we're taking off a suit of armor.
Yeah. I'm going to turn it open now, Joanna, to the 80 people who've joined us. What I think I'd like to do is actually have a question on hope. And the context for this, Joanna, is I have been criticized for taking away hope by talking about how I believe now that a societal collapse is inevitable. And so I know you've done quite a bit of work on hope in the past. Now we have a question on hope from Iwan.
I was a student of Jiddu Krishnamurti, and he used to say that hope must die. And I wonder how you relate to that.
Well, he's got a point. When I co-wrote the last book called Active Hope, my people who'd been with me over the decades couldn't believe I had written anything with the word hope in it, because I had been experiencing and saying and teaching all along, that if your attachment to hope takes you out of the present moment, and this is where you can act. You can't act yesterday. You can't act tomorrow or next year. You can act now. Now is this huge, beautiful arena of the present moment. And this is where you can make a difference. And so hope actually takes you out of the present into what you conjecture. However, with my co-author, Chris Johnstone, who's living up in Northern Scotland now, and we actually wrote the book by Skype, which is quite a romp. And what we did was combine it with both systems theory and the Buddhist teachings, where what you can do in the moment with your intention to know what you want, what you wish for, what you love, the civilizational program that you want to get behind, even if you feel it's unlikely. And so we linked hope with intention, which is what actually both in both systems and Buddhism happens. That's active hope. Active hope is what you can do, what you see yourself and choosing to do. It's that great thing we have, which is choice. There are people choosing to be online right at the moment. And those who have a last to choose, that they have to go because their babysitter's gone.
Thank you.
There's a question from Linda. It's to do with being a speaker and a teacher.
I have so much trouble today finding my own voice in this, being a voice for the voiceless, and I can't find my own voice. And so I'm wondering if you might have some thoughts about that.
Well, I think this is can be a very fruitful situation. Give yourself a break from your own voice. There's so many people who are shooting off their opinions. How do you know what's your own voice? But you can let other parts of you speak. You can let your taste buds speak, or your feelings of your heart speak. Oh, this is good. Oh, this scares me. You can write stories, or you can ask questions. You can turn from not having your voice to having being of this blessed state of curiosity and inviting people to speak how they see the world. What scares them? What worries them? What do they love? Our first question in a climate emergency meeting a week or two ago, I did an open sentence, which was, as I face collapse of our culture, what I'm grateful for is. That's a wonderful question. Try it.
That's a brilliant, brilliant. It's really powerful for me to hear that as well, Joanna. Everybody wants someone with the answers. Everyone wants someone to give them a pep talk. And
you know what? Excuse me. They don't want it. They don't want your answer. Basically, they ask as if they want. But what they, in their deepest heart, they want to hear the voice inside them.
Yes, very beautifully put. I've seen quite a few questions are now coming into the chat box. Wow. I'm going to go to Becca.
Thank you once again. And what I'm coming up against a lot at the moment is really dealing with people's existential crisis and grief around what's happening. And I'm trying to understand the best way to support them through their own coming to terms with what is.
We've been given this beautiful life, this beautiful planet. If you let yourself really love it, let yourself be open to what the ancient ones and the indigenous people and the contemporary science, this is a living planet. You can grow your life in widening circles that reach out across the world. You're that big. We're liberated from that little prison cell of the ego. And then when you're in widening circles, you see pain. Oh, yes, you do. But you see also the beauty of this planet out of which we grow. I don't believe we're coming from anywhere else. We weren't manufactured. You see, what's falling apart is a demented system, a political economic system of the industrial growth society. Corporate capitalism and its guises in countries that don't like to use the word capitalism, but they are commodifying our mother. They're breaking her up and eating, devouring that. This needs to be destroyed. This needs to come apart. And so we look at this, how can we love this world as this demented and destructive political economy dies? We go into a system, what we call in systems thinking, positive disintegration. This happens actually at every stage of the evolutionary, as we evolve from one level of evolution to another. The old codes, the old appetites, the old fears have to come apart. The armor has to be taken off so that the soft, sensitive skin and fingertips, so that the vulnerable parts, eyes and lips and ears, can grow so that we can grow in connection. It's only to connect. We grow and learn in connection. And the industrial growth society forgot about that. Because you can't build connection in a factory.
Can I just come in on that, Joanna?
Yeah.
You're pointing to, well, some people tell me that actually, why do I sound so gloomy or terrified about collapse? If it's the collapse of industrial consumer growth society, which has been so abusive not only to nature but to our nature, then why be so doom and gloom about it? And I think, well, because there's going to be quite a lot of pain along the way, and maybe people dying young and so on. So yeah, what's your response to the people who say, oh, let's just welcome collapse, it's about time?
Well, I can see their point, but we can't just say toss it all. So we can try to make what I was hearing already in the 90s, as more and more people were recognizing the mortality or the short-livedness of this corporate capitalism, that we need to bring it to a soft landing. And that was even back then contemplated that we could. We try to acquaint people with the necessity of this, maybe, so that they don't blame each other. It's the blaming the system. Otherwise, they turn that this is all because of Trump, or all because of Mexicans trying to get into the States, or, you know, we blame each other. That's pointless. We've all made a huge mistake.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we humans could make a bad situation worse rather than learn from it and have this as a rather tough invitation to awakening. I'd like to call on Azul.
Bonsoir, Joanna. Joanna, originally my question was, if you were speaking from the river, what would you say to us? But I remember that you have a tree outside the window that you love very much. So perhaps we could change the river to the tree, whatever you choose.
You know that last sonnet of Rilke's that I love so much. And he says, and if the world has ceased to hear you, say to the silent earth, I flow, and to the rushing water, speak, I am. We experience our interexistence. I had a wonderful revelation at the Dart River near you, where a wonderful swan spoke to me the year my husband died. The earth is alive, as you know. We can awaken to that. Awaken that the earth holds us. The poets know that. Our ancestors knew that. The early ones know that. And to be with our mother as she's suffering, could anything be sweeter than to be with her in this hard time? We discover our love all over again. Music's wonderful. Rushing rivers are wonderful. Poetry's wonderful.
Thank you, Joanna. I'm loving the reaction on faces around the world through this digital system. I'm seeing faces with tears of joy. So I don't know quite how to ask this question. You just turned 90. I was wondering, as death becomes less of an abstract thing in your own life, I mean, who knows, I might die tomorrow, but it there's a sense that it may be more imminent now. How is that, if anything, changing your outlook? And does that, can we learn anything from that? As we fear our own mortality, as we look at what's happening with climate change and a breakdown in our own way of life?
I don't fear it. I want to stay around as long as I can keep up with what's happening. I think this is the most exquisite moment on earth. I think the conversation we're having now is the conversation we all need to have. We all need to fall in love again with what is. And what is an exquisite planet with wonderful arts and great species. And we have a chance to move together and not blow ourselves up and not kill ourselves with these misplaced fears. You know, Jim, I think at Buddha fields around the universe, people are lining up to be born on Earth right now, to be here now, because this is a moment of such exquisite realization.
You heard parts of a 50-minute conversation with the author, scholar of Buddhism, systems thinking, and deep ecology, Joanna Macy, hosted by Jem Bendel, professor of sustainability leadership at the University of Cumbria, UK. He's founder of the Deep Adaptation Forum, an online monthly conversation about how to prepare for the collapse of industrial civilization. You can find links to the forum and their websites on TUC Radio's website. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. My name is Maria Glodden. Thank you for listening.